You know, in music scene, we meet a lot of famous national museums, but there's a local musician who lives here, a guy named Tom Gribben. But Tom Gribben is more than just a famous musician. He's an author. He's a producer. And he is just a bon vivant. And I want to welcome Tom to studio. Hello, Tom.
It's great to be here, Nanette.
Tom and I met at the Mahaffey many years ago. He's got an Olympic swimmer for a wife.
Yes, from Great Britain's national team.
The lovely Sheila, and we do a shout-out to her. But this show is all about Tom. Tom, I want to start with your backstory as a musician. And for the people who don't know you, let's talk a little bit about that band and how you became a rock and roll world star.
I don't know if it was that big, but it was pretty heady at the time. I was a practicing lawyer. I'm from St. Pete, but I was practicing down in Miami. And we put a little band together up here, and I used to come up here on the weekends and play. You know, I'd fly up to make $25. It was crazy. And it just took off. We got lucky. I met Jimmy Buffett's bass player, Harry, who was living in Madeira Beach at the time. And he took to what it was I was doing. And, of course, he introduced me to Jimmy, and then things took off. And I got a record deal up in Nashville, and put the band, another band together for that. And that was the band that really hit it.
And what the name of that band?
Tom Gribben and the Saltwater Cowboys.
That's right. Saltwater Cowboys. You guys still play, I know before the hurricane, you used to play on your birthday?
Every year in January, first week in January out of Katiki. I like to do where we don't charge anything. But, you know, of course, Katiki's a little small for us. And so they set up another bar and it's just packed. And I like to do it every year. But I also go out, you know, the individual members of the band, they have other bands, and so I go out and sit in with them, do a few songs here and there.
You still got that voice going.
We'll see. Yeah. It hasn't given up on me yet.
You know, we used to talk. You used to come to my office, and we would sit and talk about these incredible...
I missed you when you left, too.
Yeah, I missed you, too. The tales of Tom. And now... I mean, I bought the book. The book is amazing. It's called Boy. The names might be changed, but no one is innocent.
It's called The Last Florida Boy.
That's right.
Yes.
The Last Florida Boy.
The names might be changed, but no one is innocent.
Tell us a little bit about life, and tell us a little bit about the backstories, because you had thousands of these stories.
Well, in the book, it's sort of the 70s, 80s Florida, sort of the end of the freewheeling, independent pot smuggler guys, you know, long before there was sort of violence and cartels, and the beginning of the stand-up comedy era, which is in the mid-80s, is when I started the Coconuts Comedy Club chain with my partner, Bob. And so the book sort of was percolating all those years. A lot of those guys who were the independent smugglers and everything are guys that grew up here in St. Pete Beach, and I played Little League baseball with and everything like that. And I was in law school in Gainesville at the time in the 70s when the Steinhatchee 7 got busted. And they were all guys from St. Pete and the guys I played ball with. And so I'd go out to the trial every day because I wanted to meet their lawyers. They had famous lawyers there. Percy Forman was on the cover of Time and everything. So I went out there and I asked a couple of the guys, Steve Lamb, I went, you know, introduced me to Percy. So we'd go out to dinner at night, and I'd sit through the trial during the daytime. And as I listened to the evidence roll out, it just didn't seem criminal to me. These are just guys and their dads and fishermen and surfers, and they'd pick up this pot. It just didn't seem, here I was in law school. And so the idea for the book sort of germinated from those days. And then several years later, I started writing the book, and I used... You know, it is about pot smuggling. It is about stand-up comedy. But it's really just a vehicle for someone, you know, experiencing changes in life, the main character, and having to change his name. And, you know, in history, there's a lot of people who were born with one name and they earned another name. It could be an Indian born, you know, in the meadows and through his actions and through his dreams, or he became Crazy Horse, and that's what we know him. And he had to earn that name. You know, Richard Starkey.
Right, of course.
You know, he became Ringo Starr. And then he took the subsequent years and earned that name. And so this guy in the book is forced to do the same thing, and he's troubled about it, and his friend was just going, well, this is an opportunity for you to, you know, be the person you really wanted to be. And it was his struggle with all these things. But it's a lot of fun. And I'm dealing with some people, some producers from Netflix right now to do a 5-part series on it.
That's fabulous. We always said Netflix.
Yeah. Let me tell you this.
Who's going to play John Bellamy?
You know what?
You
know what I'd love to have him play is, I forgot his name, Austin,
Butler.
Austin Butler. I'd love to get it to him. And
Austin Butler, your role is calling.
Well, here's how it works. I already have a producer who's won 2 Oscars, and I already have people with the money and everything. But what happens is to get on Netflix or even to just do a regular movie depends on the director. If you get the right director, then you can call up a guy like Austin Butler. But if you get a no name, you're not going to attract and deal with great screenwriters. So what happens is where I'm at in the process, Nanette, is that there are 2, they call them showrunners on TV.
Chandra Rhimes, right.
2 of the most successful Netflix showrunners, you know, my guys are pitching it to them because if we got them aboard, we could get all the top people. So anyway, the way it is, one of the showrunners, I won't say his name because we're not committed yet, liked it. And so where I am is I'm in a stack of the stuff he'll get around to. I don't know whether I'm 20th, 30th, 7th, but I do know this, that if someone like Brad Pitt comes along with a project, with a name, or Scorsese or something like that, that goes on the top, and I go from 24th to 25th. You know, and so I'm in that stack, which is a lot of people don't get that far. And I know that, you know, that TV show Bad Monkey?
Absolutely.
Comes from the Carl Hiaasen book.
Yep, yep.
So I heard, you know, Carl Hiaasen is one of my favorite authors and probably the most famous Florida author. He waited 7 years. So if a guy like that has to wait 7 years from to do this process, you know, I may not live to see my book put out in Netflix. Although they assure me, they just said, be patient. There's nothing I can do. No one's written me a check yet.
You know, and honestly, the life of boozy pirates and beach town heroes. I mean, I saw Outer Banks. I see all of these things. I know. I read the book, and I heard the stories that are not even in this book. I think you may be working on a second book.
I am working on a second book, but this one is different. The new book is different than that.
Give us a little.
I'm not going to do that just yet. This is, but you're going to get more of, you know, that's a fiction book, and that book reads like facts because it's all based on real things that happened
and real friendships.
I've changed real friendships. You know, I might have changed locations. I might have changed names, but it reads true. Because everything that happened in the book happened somewhere along the life to one of the comedians or one of the things, you know. And I know, you know, Jimmy Buffett's in the book, and that was a whole funny scenario. The band, you know, a bunch of guys in his band that I used to run around with Jimmy. I hadn't seen him in years and years and years. So one of the band guys brought him the book. You know, because, you know, I wrote a bunch of stuff in there that I hadn't run by him, but I couldn't sort of get it to him. So I was waiting for one of his lawyers to call me. But the last time he came through Tampa, he didn't play at the amphitheater. He played over at the Amalie Arena. You know, over the years ago, 20, 30 years ago, for as long as I've known him since the end of the 70s, you could call him up or one of his people and get free tickets and all that. But once he got on with Live Nation, I could get tickets, and he'd sell them to me for face value, but there were no free tickets anymore.
Oh, we know that story, right?
But you could get front row tickets that go for $3,000 for $115 or whatever. So it was fun, and I'd always call down to Cindy at Flyby Night in Key West, which is – that office is finally closed. But all these years, I never called Jay, I called Cindy. And you know, so I basically, I'm begging you for 4. She goes, all right, well, I'll have to call you back. I got to run by Jimmy. 3 days later, Jimmy said, okay.
So he must have liked the book.
No, this was before the book. So what happened is the last, you know, Jimmy was struggling through some serious physical problems, you know, and so he had canceled a couple shows. But he came back to do this December show at the Amalie Arena, and I got a call, not from Jimmy, but from one of the guys in the band, and saying that, how would you and your wife like to come, you know, as our guest? Now, I didn't have to buy the tickets after all these years, and I was going, of course I'll go. And, of course, Sheila had never seen Jimmy. She's heard about him from all of us. But there I was. It was like the old days. And, of course, it was during the COVID times, so that there was no backstage. You couldn't go backstage and see him or see the guys in the band. I'd always go backstage and always see the band, whether I saw Jimmy or not, I'd be back. And I knew a lot of guys in the band, Robert Utley and a lot of the guys. Anyway, so it was funny. So, and that was after the book, after he got a hit. And so I sort of started telling everybody, well, I guess he approved it because we got invited free tickets to the show after all those years of buying them.
Well, you know, we know you're a lawyer. We know that you're in love. We know that you have been a comedy producer, and we know you love golf. But I know that you're also working with the Palladium now producing shows. So you've had a good year. Tell us about some of the shows and also your relationship with John Prine and John Prine Jr.
Well, the Palladium is, you know, after working in, you know, the atmosphere at the Mahaffey, and I loved Big Three and Big Three Records. But when all that went by the way, you know, I just finally got tired of the Mahaffey. And then going over to the Palladium, it's like a real team over there. It's owned by the college, but they're more interested in, you know, serving the community. And there's no ticket fees or anything like that. And, you know, if it's a $45 ticket, it's $45. That includes a tax. And I really enjoyed that whole philosophy. So I've been over there producing both music and comedy shows.
With John LaBuddy, some of them?
With LaBuddy, yeah, sometimes. And, yeah, you know, John and I are old friends. And right. John and I, we started
Reno Surf Shack, but also all the restaurants.
John's got his hand in everything. One of my favorite guys in St. Pete, to be honest with you. And the best thing about John is that he, you know, in this business, you just run into a lot of flaky people. He always does what he says. You know what I mean? I don't have
just
to get
like
anything
you
in writing with John.
That's right.
And I always appreciate that. He's not into the entertainment business. But if you sit down and you agree on something, we got going along. I never even started papering it up. We just, you know.
No writers, no nothing.
What a great guy to deal with. And so anyway, I started really enjoying the Palladium. And now they're going to completely renovate the Palladium. So I got on their committee to raise the money. It's about $13.5 million. It's going to be the nicest 800-seat theater in the southeast, at least the state of Florida. You should see the plans. It is just incredible. You can even buy a seat, you know, with your name on it. Anyway, excuse me. So I really enjoyed, and we've raised a lot of money in the state and the city and the county and everybody, even the governor that's vetoed all the other grants,
all the other,
he didn't veto the Palladium like 2 years in a row. We're probably next summer probably going to close
right.
down. I love working with Paul Wilburn over there. So hanging out with Paul Wilburn,
Palladium Paul.
Yes, well, with Paul and John LaBuddy, it's like this is how the business is supposed to be.
What are some of the shows you've done there so far? I mean, you had a couple,
Dean Napolitano. I've done some really good comedy. You know, comedy is being done all over town.
Right.
And so it's just so much of it. And I remember my partner and I, back in the late 80s, we opened up the first Coconuts Comedy Club. And we're the longest, the oldest continuing run comedy club in the state of Florida.
Right.
In the state of Florida. But we opened up in St. Pete Beach, and we didn't really know what we were doing. But it was in the days when there was no HBO and no Comedy Central or any of that. So if you wanted to see a comedian, you'd go to a comedy club. And we just... You know, Marriott owned that Howard Johnson's at the time, and they saw the numbers. Said, "Would you like to open?" And we opened in Lakeland, then Miami, and pretty soon we were opening all over the state. And then other hotels like Marriott and Hyatt, and all of a sudden we had, you know, over the years that we were opening, we had 100 clubs over in cities all over the world, in London, in Florence, Italy, and we had down in the islands. We had one in the Cayman Islands there that ran for 15 years. And we were down there when they filmed The Firm, and when they were dancing out on the patio before Tom Cruise went down the beach and had that affair with the girl. That was done on the patio of our comedy club at the Holiday Inn.
I remember being in the Caymans and going to that comedy club.
Yeah, that was ours, Coconuts Comedy Club. And so it, you know, but now comedy has become so prevalent everywhere. So the comedy club business has shrunk, you know, really. So there's like one club that my partner runs left.
Right.
But it got me in the business. And during a time in the business where, you know, like Bud Friedman from the Improv and
Mitzi Shore.
We're all in that same category. So I was connected in that way in the business. And so I have a lot. So the Palladium needed some comedy. And so we're trying to do sort of like high class comedy, not Not to say that anything else is worse, but there's so much comedy going around this town.
I call it also the anti-cussing intelligent comedy because I saw a couple of the shows.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we can throw some
F-bombs, yeah.
We can throw some cussing and some, you know, unintelligent guys up there too, but they got to be funny. If you're not laughing, we haven't achieved our goal. But yes, you're right. People are used to doing TV, and on TV you can't do that kind of thing. So we've had some really great shows here. I've done a lot of music shows. You asked me about John Prine, his son Tommy. I remember, you know, I don't know if you know this, but my band, I opened for John Prine at the Tampa Theater.
Did not know that.
In 1979, and that's the night my son was born. And I had to go from the stage to the hospital. Of course, I named him John. And John, you know, John's played 10,000 gigs around the world, but he remembers that night because there's no cell phones in those days. It was just a one phone backstage. You had to, if you're at the Tampa Theater, you had to walk down the stairs. And so my brother-in-law came with me. He just stood by the phone because they said, it's false labor. We'll, you know, call back in an hour. So I did my show and couldn't get through. And then finally, we couldn't get through. And John is playing his songs. And in between songs, he'd walk behind the speaker and go, have you heard yet? Have you heard yet? I'm going, no. He said, you better go. So I got up and I left. And I walked in over at Bayfront. And I walked in there and you know, they handed me cesarean section. They handed me my kid and I held him up like Kunta Kinte, you know. Like,
the Lion King.
This big kid, you know. So I named him John. And then so it's funny, later on when he had a son, he named him Tommy.
Who just had a child. They just had a grandson.
Who just had a grandson. Yeah,
so Theodore. If you're listening to us, where local music lives in Radio St. Pete.
So when Tommy started touring, I said, I'll do I'm going to help the family. It wasn't really to do it to make money. We started at the Hideaway, 100 seats. And then we, you know.
Love the Hideaway.
And then over at the Blade, and we sold that out. So when Tommy comes through town, it's one of my shows. And I love the kid. And I want the kid is a funny kid.
Why don't you have him on a podcast with you? We can have him call in.
Well, I'd love to.
Let's do that.
I'd love to have he would love to do it. The thing about Tommy, he's really funny. And when he was young, I wanted to. When he was, you know, before high school, I wanted to make him a comedian. And I wanted, he'd be the only, and you know, he'd be talking about MySpace and that stuff that at the time that young people, they were too young to be talking about. And I was going to move him, you know, like Britney Spears. I was going to start him out as a funny kid. And then as he grew older, move him, get him, you know, dirtier and dirtier, you know, like it caused a scene. And John loved it. We laughed about it. And you are
a star maker. I mean, this is the thing we haven't said.
I had a record deal for the kid and everything like that. And Fiona, John called me up and goes, the plan's off. I had a tour. I mean, the kid's 14 years old, and I had him had writers for him, and he was going to do these kid friendly stuff. You know, it's like Britney or any of those people doing the Disney stuff, or Miley,
the
and then they
Brothers.
Move on and they become more adult. And I had this whole plan for him, like, and John was loving it and fun. He said, Fiona's not going to buy this. So when he became a musician, and he's still funny, still very funny. You know, I decided just wanted to be helpful to the family.
It was a great show.
He's charming, and of course, you know, he's twice as good now. He's really doing national tours. But when he comes back through, I'll call you up. Come and be my guest. Come
Absolutely.
Out and see Tommy.
So, you know, folks, we are here on Music Scene with the one and only Tom Gribben. He wrote The Last Florida Boy, musician, a bon vivant, a producer. I want to go backstage with Tom.
Bon vivant.
I want to go backstage with Tom and talk about some of the celebrities and the musicians and things you've seen in the green rooms. Let's start with David Letterman.
Well, David Letterman's green room is really funny. You know, David, his show, he's got that air conditioner down to 50 degrees because he doesn't want to sweat or anything. So
he wants the guests to just chill.
Anyone on the show is cold. And so I used to go up there a lot because Eddie Brill, who booked the comedians there, I'd go up and see Eddie. And I'd go there so many times that I'd come in the back door and the guy at the back door knew who I was. And so he let me in. But you run into some funny people. I remember when Selma Hayek was on the show, and I was talking to her and her manager, and we were in the green room talking. And I like Selma Hayek, and I think she's pretty and everything. But in person, she's stunning. She's just stunning. I mean, you know.
Like drop dead jaw dropping.
I mean, really, yeah, it's stunning in person. Not so much to me on TV, but stunning in person. And I remember she had this little dress on, and they were. I was standing on the side of the stage when they were announcing her. And Biff came with a big, one of those big coats you wear in the meat room. And so she's standing, they've got this coat on her. And then, you know, and here, somehow, can they take the, and then she walks out on stage, but it's just freezing. I was going, well, good luck in that dress, you know.
Our green room is nothing like that. And
no.
Thank you, Thrive GTSP, for hosting us. Tom, what about backstage with some of the musicians that you worked with and some of the funny things? What would you put in the, I mean, I know you did the writers and things, and I remember in San Diego, Chuck Mangione had to have Bosco.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of the backstage antics, I'm not free to say, or maybe you'll read about him in my new book. But one of the funniest things that ever happened to me backstage, and you'll appreciate this. I was over to England, and a friend of mine, who was the drummer and producer for Nancy Griffith. You know, we went over. He invited me over for Christmas, and so we went out to see Dire Straits. And wow. I, of all the people that I've met, and I've met and gone to parties with Clapton and all these people, but I always wanted to meet Mark Knopfler. He's just something, one of those things. So we went out, and the bass player, John Ilsley, was considering coming to play with me the year that Dire Straits wasn't doing anything. And I just couldn't afford to fly a guy over from England and do all that. And, of course, then they started up again. They did Money for Nothing. And I used to tease John, going like, oh, you made a bad business decision sticking with the Money for Nothing when you could have come over here to St. Pete Beach. But anyway, wanted to meet John, and we were with another friend of mine who was this really loud, obnoxious guy. And so after the show, we were backstage, and the whole band, and I was talking to John. I couldn't see Mark, and he wasn't anywhere. And over to the side was this other friend of mine with this obnoxious woman from New York, and they were yelling and throwing the F-bombs around, and we were pretending like we didn't know him. And finally, he's calling, Tom, come over here. Come on. And I'm going, I don't know you. And he says, I want you to meet somebody. And he introduced me to this woman, and she's from New York, Upper East Side chick, you know what I mean? Typical New York. I mean, just the greatest, and with a big loud voice and everything. And so my friend said to her, you know, the only reason Tom's here is he wanted to meet Mark Knopfler. And she goes, really? Well, come with me. And she grabs me. We walk all the way back through the labyrinth of rooms. And she opens up a room, and she opens the door. Doesn't even knock. Just opens the door and goes, honey, I want you to meet my friend. It's Mark Knopfler's wife.
Hey, listen, you meet a lot of people. That's a great story.
And then he says, I'm having fun with his friend. She shoves me in, shut the door, and said, you know, and I sat there for 45 minutes while he played guitar and played me these new songs he was writing. It was one of my favorite backstage experiences, and I've had plenty of them.
You've had plenty. Folks, we hope to have Tom here on a regular basis in Radio St. Pete, talking music, talking memories, talking with musicians and comedians. Tom, it's always a pleasure to have you
here. It's good to see you, too.
For Radio St. Pete, I'm your host, Annette Weiser. This has been Music Scene with Tom Gribben. By the book.